You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 121, covering the week of May 14th through May 18th, 2018. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. You can follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute. You can like us on Facebook at Abbeville Institute. And of course, you can subscribe to our YouTube page at Abbeville Institute. If you want to find all those things and search for them, you go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you'll find all of our social media buttons, as well as our Amazon Smile button. So while you're shopping at Amazon, you can help contribute to the Abbeville Institute. While you're there, you also want to give us an email address, and we'll give you a free ebook, Kirkpatrick Sales Emancipation Hell. You'll pick up our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday and our weekly email on Saturday or Sunday, which includes a link to this podcast. You can also support the Abbeville Institute by going to abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you'll see a button that says support. Click on that. You'll see a little tab that says donor levels or donations. And you click on that, and you'll see all of our various levels for donating. You can donate monthly or annually. All the options are there. So go and click on that. We have a new interface with that, too, which I think does help facilitate the process. So go check that out. If you have not donated to the Institute, please do so. You do help us explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition, and your donation is tax-deductible to the full extent of the law. You can also support the Abbeville Institute by buying our apparel. You can see under the support button, there's a thing that says shop. Click on that. You can get our hats, t-shirts, polo shirts, all of that great stuff. So click on that. Get some Abbeville Institute apparel. And always remember that we have conferences for your enjoyment, for the public and also for academics. We do have one coming up in July. It's our summer school, July 15th through 20th. It's on the topic of Southern music. It's actually Southern identity through Southern music. It's going to be a wonderful time. We have Bobby Horton as our keynote speaker on Wednesday night of the week. So go on out and check that out. Space is limited. We only have about 50 seats for the summer school, and so you want to get in on that. We do have scholarships for students, graduate students, undergraduate students, and also advanced high school students. So check out the information. It's all on our website, abbevilleinstitute.org, middle of the page. Click on that. You get Dr. Livingston's contact information. Contact him if you would like to attend the summer school. We want to see you there. It's a great time. It's at the beach. It's the 16th annual summer school, by the way. So we are happy to be putting this one on. Okay, so let's talk about the material we have for the week. We have some interesting stuff this week, and I think it's all under the theme of humility. And so I'm going to start with a Friday piece and then work my way backwards. And it's humility, the contrast between the South and the North in terms of humility. I think it's something that's interesting about this, and also the complexity of the Southern position and what all that means. And so the piece on Friday was written by Jonathan Harris. He's actually one of our students. He's attended summer schools. He's going on to get an advanced degree in history now at Liberty University. So he's wonderful student, and someone who's very much interested in the Southern tradition. And what I like about this piece is actually the end of the piece. And so he talks about how to stay humble in the academy, which is virtually impossible, it seems today, to stay humble in the academy. And he actually wrote Clyde Wilson a letter at one point asking about humility. And he talks about how when he attends these conferences that Abbeville scholars are involved with, or the summer school, how down to earth the professors seem to be, and that they're just normal people. They don't have any sense of themselves. And Clyde responded, and I think this is what sparked interest in writing this particular piece. And he attached this letter to this post, and so the way he responded to it was interesting. So I'm going to read that. And he says, quote, "These people," meaning mainstream academics, "have no religion, no culture, and no vocation." He says, "You are guilty of none of these things. All they have is their status, which they cling to rigidly. Without their status, they would be nobody. Just one more average cipher among the millions in modern urban society." And you see this on a regular basis. There was this instance not long ago where a professor out in California said some disparaging things about Barbara Bush and the Bush family. And of course, she was raked over the coals by Conservative Inc. How dare somebody do this? And her response was interesting in that particular exchange. Of course, there were people saying, well, I mean, what she's saying is she has a right to say these things. But her response was interesting. She clung, as Clyde says here, she clung to her status as a professor. That was her go-to when it came to defending herself. She would say things like, honey, I'm a professor. I'm a tenured professor. I can't be fired. I am, and she would you know, exalt this position of being a professor. She would trumpet that position because that's what made her who she was, only because she was a professor. Did she have any kind of status in her own mind? And if she wasn't a professor, maybe she would have no status. But this is the point. The people that get involved in the academy, that's what they cling to, as he says, for their status, because they are professors. That's all they have. They have no religion. They have no culture. And when he says vacation, he says, unlike you, they have no drive to understand life and our great cultural heritage, no devotion to learning. They have merely picked out some niche of expertise that will give them status in a bureaucratic, soulless society. This is true. You look at the academy, you look at what you go into a history profession if you want to get an advanced degree, and you pick a field. And I'm asked this all the time. What is your specialty? When I tell people what I do or that I have a degree in history, and well, what is your specialty? Because that's what they think. This is what we do. And not just that. In that specialty, they pick one little area to focus on. Just one little area. And in that one little area, they become so pedantic that no one even wants to talk to them about it. And they lack the broad picture. And they think that one little area explains everything, explains it all. This is the problem. And so they focus on, 19th century gender relationships in New York urban society. And so because of that, that becomes American history. And they go out and they teach American history. Maybe they even teach Western civilization without any understanding of Western civilization whatsoever. But that's it. This is what they get. They have a cursory understanding, and not even that at times, of anything outside of their particular area of expertise. And so they view everything through that lens. If they think that gender relationships in 19th century urban New York were one particular way, then that actually applies to everything in American history. So this is the point. And then they become very thin-skinned. And that's academics in general. Academics are thin-skinned. But they're very thin-skinned. And when you attack their positions and you expose holes in their positions, they can't take it. And so they can't be humble because they have to make themselves feel better. Their position is right. So humility actually shows that maybe I'm not always right about everything. Maybe there's more to this. I want to know. I'm curious about things. I don't know these things. And so this actually gets into Yankeeism. You see, the Yankee is this way. They're know-it-alls. They're busybodies. They're nosy. They want to do things and involve themselves in things they have no business being involved in. That's the problem, you see. They don't want to just sweep around their own back porch. They want to sweep around everybody's back porch. And that's because of their quote-unquote expertise. They think they can do that, that they know more than other people. There was I've talked about this book on this podcast before, Pryor's Misreading the Man. I call it Misreading the Man, but Pryor's Reading the Man, which is about Robert E. Lee. And apparently, of course, she was killed in a car wreck a couple of years ago. Apparently, when she would go to meetings that had to deal with Lee and this question of Lee, she would get very upset with people and say, I know Robert E. Lee and you don't know Robert E. Lee. She would get nasty because of her quote-unquote expertise, because she had been given this chest of letters that nobody else had seen, and of course she published them in her book, or you know, parts of them. And that made her understand Robert E. Lee better than anybody else, better than anybody, better than Douglas Southall Freeman. She understood him better. This is the Yankee in her coming out. She was the expert, and when you criticized her, when you took a position that she thought was just so wrong, she was willing to tell you. Because that's what gave her status. She was invited to speak, and if you tear that down, then she no longer has any status. There's nothing. You see, to people like myself or other people in the Institute, this is just something we do. It's not our status. Our status is something else in life. Our status is husband or father. That's our status. These are just things we do. These are things we're interested in. They're things we do. They're things we like to do. We like to talk about history. We like to talk about the South. But it's not our. It's not our be-all, end-all. But to some of these people, this is it. They are devoted to the academy. They're devoted to the institution. They're devoted to the bureaucracy, because it gives them worth. My worth is not this. I only do this because I have to have an outlet to talk about it. Or I would talk about it to my family all day long and they would get tired of it. So I have to talk about it to somebody else. So I talk into the microphone and write things and do things. So, but that doesn't give me status. What gives me status is the people in my life. Outside of what I do for a vocation or for a job or as a hobby. But if your entire life is wrapped up in this position that you have been given because you went to school for a certain time or whatever, you are Dr. So-and-so, and you force everyone to address you that way, that is your status. And if you tear that down, if you say, well, what you wrote is not correct, maybe there's something wrong with what you wrote, well, that's tearing apart not only their scholarship, but it's also tearing apart their life, because they built their life on that. So that's an important part to understand of the academy and how that works. And this is why people get so thin-skinned. So within that idea, this is why when you talk about Confederate monuments, you talk about Confederate symbols, you talk about Southern history, you talk about these things, people bank their entire life on their status and it taking these things down or tearing them apart or whatever the case may be. Being the expert, quote-unquote expert, on Confederate monuments and what they mean. What I find in the Abbeville Institute is most of the scholars could care less about being the known expert on a particular thing. Doesn't matter. We just want to make sure people know the information. Whoever gets it there, great. But this piece on this idea of the Yankee and what this means, that you want to sweep around somebody else's back door, you want to sweep around their front porch, whatever it is, gets into the monument question. And the piece we published on Thursday, so I'm kind of working backwards here, and then I'll tie into this in a different way. The piece that was published on Thursday by Thomas Crane. Thomas Crane is a lawyer. He actually works in civil rights cases. And he's a veteran, United States veteran, served in the first Gulf War in the early 90s. But he's argued several civil rights cases. And he said the problem with the attack on the Confederate monuments and calling them racist is that there's no evidence to it. Most of it is circumstantial. And he brings up that the monuments could have been erected, as there's a piece written about this that he cites. A 1983 article by John Winberry. The title of the article was "Lest We Forget the Confederate Monuments in the Southern Townscape." And Winberry says there's four potential reasons why these monuments were erected, and it could have been one or two or three or all four why these monuments were erected. And what Mr. Crane says in this is that you have to have conclusive proof. Just because you think you might know, that doesn't actually hold up in a court of law. And even if you look at the speeches that were given, that's not enough. Does that speech identify the people that actually erected the monument, put it there, why they did it? No, it doesn't. And so when he gets into this, he actually points out that if this case was to go to a court, it would fall apart immediately because there's not enough evidence. But historians just accuse people, and because there's no court, because all it is essentially is opinion, and the court of emotion, which is what really we're playing on here. There is one issue with this that I have, and that we're dealing with emotion. We're dealing with emotivism. We're not dealing with logical people. We're dealing with people who are illogical. And so you can't give logic to illogical people. It just doesn't work that way. This is an emotional attack. And the purpose, of course, is not necessarily just to tear down the monuments. The purpose is to tear down Western civilization, as we've mentioned on this podcast dozens and dozens of times. So the thing I like about this, though, is he actually says, look, I'm a civil rights attorney. This is what I do. I actually accuse people of discrimination. I have to go in and argue every day racism. I have to show it. And he says there's no case to be made here that these monuments are in any way racist. He says, the challenge in showing discrimination is that in relying on bake sales and bazaars, the San Antonio chapter of the UDC relied on contributions from hundreds of persons. Not just one person, but hundreds of people. And he says hundreds or thousands is a lot of people. It is simply not credible in any discrimination case that hundreds or thousands are any more racist than the general population of any given community. He says, if I tried to file a lawsuit alleging a large group of white persons discriminated against my client, I would expect to be sanctioned by the judge for filing a frivolous lawsuit. He says, if modern-day historians seek to look back and accuse an entire city of racism, then that charge would likely lie against any city in the United States at the time. It just stretches credibility to believe one city was guilty of excessive racism at any given point in time. He says, the other very significant obstacle to accusing a particular Confederate statue of racist intent is alternate explanations. Discrimination lawsuits hinge often on the employer's preferred explanation for why a person was fired. The employee will claim he was fired because of discrimination, but if the employer can offer a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for the firing, the employer will likely prevail. In most discrimination cases, a lawsuit will depend on the quality of the employer's preferred explanation. The challenge regarding the Confederate monuments is there's always a legitimate alternate explanation. That's an important sentence. There is always a legitimate alternate explanation. The United Daughters of the Confederacy was founded expressly to commemorate the deceased Confederate veteran. The Confederate States of America was not the United States of America. That means there was no government effort to mark the passing of these hundreds or thousands of veterans. If the UDC or some organization like the UDC did not raise the funds for these monuments, it would not be done. And so, this is the rub. No one can say that there is conclusive evidence in any particular case that any of these monuments were erected for racist intent. There was no evidence, but people throw it against the wall and they smear it because that's what they think can happen. And of course, it evokes an emotional response, and that's the problem. I point back to an exchange I had with a prominent Princeton professor at one point when I asked him to show me evidence that any of these monuments were erected for racist reasons. He gave me David Blight's book, which is an idiotic book. So he gave me that, but he could not point to anything else, and then he just blocked me, because you see, his entire status is based on a lack of humility. His entire status was under threat, because I challenged him to show me something. Of course, I have the same degree he has, I just don't teach at Princeton, but I have the same degree, but when you challenged him, block. There's no discussion. There's no discussion. But this is the point. These people have no culture. They have nothing but their status, and so their status is tied into tearing things down, to showing the other side as being bad. That elevates them. I'm good, they're bad. That's the Yankee. I'm good, they're bad. And so the piece on Wednesday, Yankee sanctification, got into that very issue. And this piece was reprinted on LouRockwell.com. And so you look at the North and what they were doing. And well, interesting thing, you know, if we talk about some of these issues, and I've mentioned them on this particular podcast as well, some of the issues that are exclusively identified with the South are really American. You know, if you talk about racism, as Crane said, you can't point to any city being any more racist than another in the 19th century, early 20th century. You crazy? Issues like pro-slavery ideology came out of the North. Jim Crow came out of the North. All these things. These are all American things. The entire anti-slavery movement was really not abolitionist. It was just we didn't like slavery. But tied into that was an excessive amount of racism. So all these things are important. But you see, you have to have a good and you have to have a bad. You have to have someone elevated and someone lowered. And the South has to be lowered while these self-righteous, delusional, as I called it years ago, Yankee self-righteous delusional disorder. You have that. They have to be the ones who are elevated. But when you look at it, and you look at what the South was, and this gets into the piece on Monday too, and you look at what the South was and what it represents, and this particular piece on Wednesday that she mentions that the CSA emblem featured George Washington. And she says he was the antithesis of soulless modernity. He represented tradition, heritage, farming, duty, loyalty, honor, roots, kith and kin, blood and soul, time and place. The things that root you, the things that make you what you really are, where you come from, your traditions. That's what makes you who you really are, not some job. George Washington wasn't George Washington because of his job. He was George Washington because of who he was. Who he was made him George Washington in the time that he had to live in. Robert E. Lee was who he was because of his people, where he came from. These things, heritage, tradition, honor, roots, kith and kin, blood and soil, time and place, all those things. And so on Monday we ran a piece entitled Southern Identity in the 21st Century. And Louis Liberman wrote this piece, and he talks about how he's reading I'll Take My Stand and seeing, gosh, and we've talked about this book on this podcast, and we've written articles on the website, but how important this is, and to rethink this for the 21st century. And of course, Clyde Wilson did this in the 80s, wrote a wonderful little collection of essays on the South, published by University of Georgia Press. You can still get a copy of it. I think in paperback, you can still buy it new. But these are questions that generations have to ask. And so what Liberman is asking, he's in his 40s, what is Southern identity now? What does it mean now? We're not talking about the 1930s. That was 90 years ago. Almost 90 years ago. We're not talking about that now. We're not talking about the same South. We're not talking about the same South in 1980. Or 1981. That was when the Dukes of Hazzard was on TV. We're not talking about that South. We're talking about a different South now. But the South, the Southern tradition, endures for a variety of reasons. And he gets into this, you know, whether it's the culture of the South, the art, the music, the food, the things that make the South, the tangible things of the South, or whether it's the idea of the South, and that's the piece on Tuesday, which we'll get into in a second here. One part of the idea of the South, whether it was that, family, Christianity, what still matters in the South? And this is a question that we often have to ponder. We're not farmers. We don't live in an agrarian society. Of course, there still are agrarians out there. We still have agrarians who are involved with the Institute, people that are certainly interested in the farming lifestyle. But most of us don't do that anymore. So what is it that lasts? I mean, if I take my stand as an agrarian critique, what is it in that agrarian critique that we can move forward with? the critique of modernity? That's certainly something to think about. What is it that gives us our identity as a people? And it doesn't matter what area of the United States. What gives a northerner an identity? What gives a westerner identity? What gives a southerner identity? What gives them identity? And again, it's these things that I just mentioned. Heritage, farming, duty, loyalty, honor, roots, kith and kin, blood and soil, time and place. These are the things that give you identity. Tradition. Tradition gives you identity. And so when we think about the South in the 21st century, that's the important part of it. That's the important part to remember. How do we think about the South in the 21st? What will the South be 50 years from now? Because 50 years from now, it may be different than it is. It will be different than it is now. But how do we hang on to these things? It's one thing we're going to be dealing with in the summer school, and it's in the two lectures I'm going to give. One is about home, place, how much that means to the South. There was actually an article the other day about people that have to move around a lot, their children that have to change schools or places over and over again. Even just one time can affect their personality in ways that people don't understand. Why? Because they lose the roots. They lose the things that make them what they are. As Bradford said, we have to remember who we are. They lose those things. Being planted in a place, I mean, it's important. It's important to have those roots, to remember those things. And so outside of all the superficial parts of the Jeffersonian tradition, that is something that we forget about with Jefferson. He was who he was because he was from Virginia. Same thing with George Washington. Same thing with Robert E. Lee. Same thing with James Madison or James Monroe. They were who they were because they were from Virginia. And you can say the same thing about Carolinians, Rutledge and Marion, and Pickens. You can say the same thing about those people. You can say the same things about people from Tennessee or Alabama or Georgia. They were who they were because of where they were from, or Mississippi, or Louisiana, or Maryland, or even Massachusetts. There's something in the place. The place helps create the culture. The culture also helps create the place. But those things work together to create a person. And so when we look at applying the Southern tradition, one part of it, of course, is this resistance to centralization. Illegal or oppressive centralization. And this piece on Tuesday's Death by Taxes, written by the late William Quirk, who was a law professor at the University of South Carolina. It's a review of the book For Good and Evil, The Impact of Taxes on the Course of Civilization. It's been reprinted in 2001 by Charles Adams. But this piece was actually published in 1993 as a book review. And it talks a lot about the Clinton administration. But he concludes the piece, and I'm not going to get into all the different parts of this because I want to stay on the theme. He concludes the piece that he says, quote, "The majority of Americans, on the other hand, are Jeffersonian. They believe in the value of the individual liberty, less government, and less taxes. To the majority, economic prosperity, political democracy, and freedom are enough. The country has to decide if it is going to follow the people's ideas or the government's ideas. It cannot follow both. Something must happen if continued deterioration is to be avoided. Some new kind of basis or basis of community must be formed." Now, we can question this. This was written, 25 years ago. We can question whether this is still true. The majority of Americans, are they still Jeffersonian? I don't know. That's a good question. I think that there's still a substantial, very powerful minority of Americans there in that case. But I think that if you look at numbers, maybe the tide has turned a little bit. People don't believe as much in individual liberty or less government. They just don't. Because of the school system. But this is, gets into the political class and what the political class thinks, and how the Jeffersonian tradition can be applied. Jeffersonianism, what that means, how that works. And I think this all gets back to tradition. You have to be rooted in something. Jefferson believed in these things because of where he was from and who he was. He just wasn't anti-tax. You cannot have a political culture based on being anti-tax. You can certainly be part of it. Why were they anti-tax, though? What did it mean for their culture and society? What did it mean for the people? I mean, you could make a case that high taxes actually is part of a political culture, too. It's the Marxist culture. They think these things are good. It's part of a political culture. Why? Because their culture is built on that. They're not rooted in the same things. So we have different Americas now. Vastly different Americas. Taxes is just one part of the Jeffersonian tradition. Decentralization is another part. But all of that has to be rooted in a real culture. It has to be rooted in a people, tradition, heritage, loyalty, honor, kith and kin, blood and soil, these type of things. It has to be rooted in something, people. And so if we get away from that, we can't just talk about superficial issues. It has to come back to status. And where do you obtain your status? You obtain your status because of who you are, not what you do. But to the Yankee sanctified person, the person with Yankee self-delusional disorder, Yankee self-righteous delusional disorder, to that person, status is everything. What that means, they're going to tear down statues because that elevates them, makes them feel better, when that statue has nothing to do with them. But that's the problem. We have an emotive response and a rational response. We also have a cultural response and a people without culture, without religion. So when you put all that together, this is where you get into humility. George Washington, to end this, George Washington, more than anything else, was humble. Just look at how he responded when he was appointed commander of the Continental Army. And how what he wrote to his wife, he said, "I'm not up to the task. They expect too much of me." When he became president, the country expected too much of him. He was humble. I know historians like to try to tear him down now. Washington was not humble. He was stuck on himself. Certainly Washington was confident, internally confident, but he was humble. Humility, important. That humility defined a Southerner. Washington was not Washington because of the fact that he was the commander of the Continental Forces. He was Washington because he was Washington and where he came from. We have to remember that when we talk about the Southern tradition. Until next time, good day.